This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Iran is making some strong moves to gain more control of the strategically important waters of the Middle East. It provoked the United States Navy in a few incidents this past year, and now an Iranian general is floating the idea of Iran actually constructing naval bases in other Middle Eastern nations. And whether or not this will happen is an open question, but it gives you a good look at Iran's ambitions. In some ways, the Middle East has become a battle for supremacy between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Right now, Egypt, which has been a longtime ally of Saudi Arabia, it looks like it might be switching sides. It took Iran's side in a United Nations vote. Saudi Arabia ended an oil deal it had recently struck with Egypt, and it's unclear where this situation will end up. But this is actually something that biblical prophecy has quite a lot to say about. We're going to talk about how these recent events may be leading to the fulfillment of those prophecies. Cuban dictator Fidel Castro died this past Saturday, and there have been some remarkably positive statements about this man from several Western leaders. We're going to talk about the real legacy of Fidel Castro and why we shouldn't be quite so positive about this man. And I'll conclude the program by talking about the importance of emotions. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. This past year saw some high-profile, alarming incidents that involved Iran's Navy. It started with a bang in January when Iran captured and humiliated 10 American sailors. This past August, some Iranian vessels harassed an American destroyer. And in a separate incident, an Iranian ship came within 200 yards of a Coast Guard patrol ship before it was chased away by warning shots. Well, now an Iranian general is suggesting that Iran might need to start creating naval bases in other Middle Eastern countries. To talk about Iran's increasing boldness in naval matters, we have Trumpet writer Callum Wood via Skype from our office in Australia. Hello, Callum.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, why don't you start by just telling us about what this general said about Iran's navy and its possible future plans here.
General in question, who came out and gave these statements to a semi-official news agency, his name, well, he's the chief of staff of the Iranian armed forces. His name is Major General Mohammad Hossein Baghiri. And his comment to state exactly what he said, one day we may need naval bases on the coasts of Yemen and Syria. Now, as you mentioned yourself, Iran's navy has been very active in 2016, that we've seen a major increase in hostile actions and in provocations towards the United States and others. We've seen it really stepping up in its traversing of the region. It recently crossed around the Horn of Africa and into the Atlantic as well. So we've really seen them stretching out their power. And so to establish naval bases in these very contested regions, especially critical regions when you consider trade as well, especially off the coast of Yemen with the Bab el-Mandab there. If you consider Iran increasing its activities in those regions, it really does threaten world trade and it threatens especially the Sunni Arabs in the region as well.
So this general mentioned specifically Syria and Yemen. And of course, Yemen is, we've been talking about this recently, and I'll be talking with Robert Morley about some of these strategic areas. But you mentioned the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and just how strategically important these areas are with respect to oil trade. Maybe you could just elaborate on that.
Yes, well, they really can't be understated how important these sea lanes are, particularly with the trade of oil. In 2015, 3.8 million barrels of oil passed through the Red Sea every single day, which is absolutely astronomical, especially when you consider where it's going. A lot of this oil is traveling up through to countries that border on the Mediterranean. It's the vital link that connects a lot of the oil fields of Saudi Arabia and Iran. These oil fields are connected through the Red Sea, through the Bab el-Mandeb, up through the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean. And so it really is this vitally important choke point. And we know that with the instability in Yemen, a lot of people are starting to worry these days that what happens if someone targets oil tankers going through there? What if that choke point starts to close up? And now that Iran's come out and said, well, hey, we're thinking about establishing a naval base there, well, that just heightens fears even more. Before, you had the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels who have been attacking or shooting at American ships, and they even did manage to sink one or two ships from the United Arab Emirates, I believe it was. These Houthis have been very active. But if we see Iran there and establishing a naval presence at a naval base, that would give Iran immense power over this region. And with so much oil flowing through, and it's only 18 miles across at its narrowest point, this would be an absolutely pivotal moment in the Middle East, especially when you consider Iran already has major control over other crucial sea lanes in the area. In the Persian Gulf, Iran, of course, has its naval bases dotted up and down the coastline there, and so it's able to patrol that region very thoroughly. And when you consider the immense amount of oil that travels through that area as well, if Iran has a choke point at the end of the Persian Gulf and at the end of the Red Sea, that just gives them absolutely immense power.
Now, the Houthi rebels actually, they made a statement saying, we're not interested in Iran having a naval presence here. They've been very welcoming to Iranian help to their cause, but they seem to be drawing the line with a naval presence there. So it seems like, if I'm understanding that right, then that if there is a line here, what this general said is maybe more of a showing of the cards in terms of their strategic interests than it would be in any specific capability that they may be able to develop.
That's exactly right. When you consider a naval base, just logistically, what Iran would have to do, there'd be a lot of infrastructure. And Bagheri himself actually made mention of this when he made this statement. He said, well, look, we understand that if we were to go ahead with this, it would take time. It would take infrastructure. And of course, it would take a lot of diplomacy as well. As you mentioned, the Houthis are not on board with this at all at the moment. One of their leaders came out on Facebook, and yes, he came out quite strongly against it. But at the end of the day, you're exactly right. I mean, whether or not they actually go through with creating these naval bases, it points to the fact of where Iran is heading, what its regional goals are. And we've seen time and time again, Iran is flexing its muscle, especially with its navy in the Persian Gulf. And Iran, they're not silly. They know that they've got a great chokehold and a great bargaining chip, you might call it, by having control over the Strait of Hormuz there at the end of the Persian Gulf. What happens, they must now look at the Red Sea and say, hey, imagine the leverage we would have over the West if we had control in both of these areas. If we had control of both the Red Sea and the Strait of Hormuz, that would give them incredible leverage. As they mentioned themselves, it would actually act as a deterrent if anyone wanted to say, impose more sanctions against Iran or invade or conduct a military strike against them. Well, they would have to contend with the point, well, Iran has control over these vital sea lanes, and if we attack them, then we've got to be ready for Iran to return fire, perhaps in one of these regions, which would be economically devastating to a lot of countries.
Well, whether or not it establishes a naval base in Yemen, you certainly have to view its activity there in precisely the kind of strategic terms that you're describing. The foothold that it has gained there definitely gives it more leverage in trying to control trade through that vital strait. And if we just look at this in terms of, say, the other moves that Iran has made with its navy, and even if we just back the frame up further and we look at it in the context of the moves that Iran has made after the nuclear deal was concluded in January, and the kind of leverage that Iran is gaining in its trade with other nations, the fact that its own oil business is flooding the market and affecting oil trade globally, we kind of have to look at all of this as one picture, don't we?
That's exactly right. The JCPOA, that nuclear deal, it might have slightly perhaps deterred Iran from pursuing its nuclear ambitions. But what it did was it just gave Iran this immense cash flow. and it's given Iran a chance to really bolster its more conventional forces that perhaps were ailing under the sanctions as well. Its navy, as we've discussed, has been more active than ever. And a lot of that has to be because Iran simply has more money to play with. They've got more money to invest in this navy. They've got the opportunity to actually strengthen themselves in this more conventional sense if they're not spending quite as much money, or if they're simply just getting more money to put towards these ventures. And obviously, instability is also a big part of that. It's not just, I don't think, the nuclear deal that's allowed this for Iran. It's actually the regional instability as a whole. When you see the Houthi rebels, let's say, in Yemen, their instability in that country has allowed Iran to come in and actually support them and play a bigger role. You could say the same for Somalia. The Somalian pirates that have been plaguing the coasts along there, well, Iran has said, hey, we're going to come down and help sort this problem out. We're going to send our naval vessels down there to guard our ships. And that's something actually just recently that Iran has said they're going to start sailing their warships up and down the Red Sea to quote unquote protect their vessels. But of course, you have to remember that, well, yes, it's understandable that you would want to protect your trade vessels. But at the same time, this is giving Iran the opportunity to sail these warships up and down through this critical sea lane where before they really had no influence whatsoever. If we remember back to 2011, 2012, when Iran sailed its warships through the Red Sea there, it was a big deal because this hadn't happened in Iran for so long. And now they're talking about simple, regular, routine sailing these warships up into the Mediterranean to quote unquote protect themselves from pirates. So the regional instability plays just as big a factor in allowing Iran to get out there and to talk about building bases, to send its ships out, its naval vessels, to conduct more exercises and sorties out there in these crucial sea lanes where really people should be worried what happens if Iran stops defending against pirates and actually becomes the aggressor themselves. And when you hear statements from the Supreme Leader where he talks about the sea being this powerful confrontational arena that they have with their enemies, it really should make people stop and consider the implications of allowing Iran into these vital areas.
Yeah, I think just looking at this development in light of this trend that we've been following for quite some time, looking at Iran's regional ambitions and its desire to really reign supreme over the Middle East, that it has been making consistent gains in these key areas. And as you said, taking advantage of the instability in these areas and stepping into the void that exists in countries like Iraq, as well as those that you mentioned, Somalia and Yemen. We definitely see this kind of inexorable development of Iran as a regional power. The nuclear deal certainly accelerated that trend, but this is something that we've had in our sights for a long time based on the prophecies of the Bible. Our trumpet editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been talking about this for over two decades, even back into the early 90s, looking at some of these prophecies and seeing how Iran may be able to fulfill these. And this really is a remarkable thing to see happen here. It's kind of like watching this develop over a period of decades, getting to the point now where it really is something that should be very obvious to anybody who's paying attention to the situation. Well, we definitely appreciate you bringing this this latest information to our attention. There is an article. Callum has written an article about this. It's actually should be posted up on thetrumpet.com shortly. It's called "Iran Suggests Broadening Naval Presence in the Middle East." There's some really eye-popping information in here. One quote that really stood out to me, talking about this Iranian general. He said that having naval bases in remote distances is not less than nuclear power. It's 10 times more important and creates deterrence. This fella is talking awfully tough for a country that supposedly is just, you know, one of the boys in the friendly neighborhood of nations. Just remarkable to see this happening. We appreciate you bringing this all to us, Callum, and thanks for your time.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Perhaps the biggest rivalry in the Middle East outside the Arab-Jew conflict is the split between Iran and Saudi Arabia for supremacy in the region. And there are a lot of areas there where these two nations are battling to gain the upper hand. One of these is beginning to emerge in Egypt. Egypt has been a close ally with Saudi Arabia for some time, but there's evidence that this may be changing. And this is a very interesting story from the standpoint of biblical prophecy. Trumpet writer Robert Morley has written an article on it, and we're here to talk about this. Hello, Robert.
Hi, good to be here.
So what looks to be a falling out between Egypt and Saudi Arabia, it seems to have been initiated by events in Syria and the Syrian civil war. What did Egypt do that ticked Saudi Arabia off here?
Right. So actually pretty dramatic. What looked like could be a pretty dramatic break between Saudi Arabia and Egypt was Egypt's decision to support the Russian position on Syria. So there was a United Nations resolution. There was actually two up for vote a couple of months back. And Egypt, against the wishes of its financial backers in Riyadh, decided that they would take the Russian position and actually support, cast their vote in support of the resolution backed by Russia that allowed them to continue with their air campaign in Syria. So bombing the Syrian rebels in Syria, the same Syrian rebels that Saudi Arabia is supporting.
Okay, so Saudi Arabia has been, well, they're right directly at odds with Russia. And we've talked about a certain amount of alignment that's taken place between Russia and Iran in terms of trying to keep the Assad regime in power, directly opposed to Saudi interests. Saudi Arabia, it looks like they took this as a direct affront to themselves.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up. On the one side, you do have Russia and Iran working together in Syria, and that's a clear-cut sides in this war. They are on the one side. Facing off against them is the rebels against the Assad regime and then the Saudi backers of those rebels. And Egypt did decide to come down on the same side as Russia and Iran in this situation as opposed to the Saudis.
And they took Saudi Arabia. This was quite a shock in Riyadh, apparently.
Well, it was because Saudi Arabia provides a lot of financial support to Egypt. And I think they felt that, and historically, Egypt and Saudi Arabia have been allies. And part of it is based on an alliance of convenience in terms they've both historically been at odds with Iran and hence Syria, the Assad regime. And some of it's financial because Saudi Arabia is an enormous backer of the Egyptian not only government, but economy. So I think the Saudis probably felt like Egypt owed them this vote, even though when you look at the Egyptian position, they didn't want to support the Saudi position in Syria because a lot of these rebels that are fighting the Assad regime in Syria also happen to be the same sorts of organizations that are allied with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a terrorist organization in Egypt that's working against the al-Sisi government in Egypt. So from Egypt's point of view, they didn't want to support a lot of those rebels up there because those same sort of rebels are the ones acting within Egypt. So you can see their reluctance to join with the Saudis.
This is such a complicated situation because we're talking about a lot of time, looking at it historically in Egypt when the Muslim Brotherhood ascended and Mohamed Morsi took power, then you saw more of an alignment between Egypt and the more radical elements within the region represented by Iran. And we've seen alignment between the Muslim Brotherhood or elements within the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas in the Gaza Strip and in Israel, which have been in the past directly sponsored by Iran. So the alignment of these elements, you've seen this sort of alignment of radical elements, but these rebels that are taking the upper hand, or they're fighting against the Assad regime, sponsored by Saudi Arabia, and are aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood. Saudi Arabia's in the picture. So it's a little bit complicated to try to get to the bottom of all of this.
Yeah, 6,000 years of rivalries and alliances, and it really can be a convoluted space down there. But in this situation, what you're basically seeing is, in the past, the Muslim Brotherhood, when they're in power, connections to Iran. Well, now we're starting to see and Egypt moving kind of in that direction. There were signs of that under the Muslim Brotherhood. But now we're seeing it in a different way, with actually the al-Sisi government getting, instead of the pull towards Iran via the Muslim Brotherhood, we're starting to see a break from their historic allies, the Saudis, potentially here, because there has been some dramatic movement on that front, even beyond the United Nations resolution on Syria.
So the upshot of all of it is that Saudi Arabia punished Egypt. I mean, you're kind of putting the dots together in terms of the reasoning behind it, but what they did really took a shot at Egypt.
Well, that's right. And Egypt was prepared for this. But what happened was after Egypt cast his vote at the United Nations, suddenly the oil from Saudi Arabia stopped flowing to Egypt. So Saudi Arabia's giant, enormous oil company, Saudi Arabia Aramco, they notified the Egyptian petroleum company that they would no longer be shipping oil to Egypt. Now, if you remember all the way back to, I think it was April, Egypt and Saudi Arabia had just signed this joint deal where Saudi Arabia was going to provide Egypt with 700,000 barrels of oil per day to Egypt. And Egypt was going to transfer two islands at the very northern terminus of the Red Sea to Saudi Arabia. And this kind of symbolized just how they were working together and how they were united. And now Egypt goes, you fast forward, last month Egypt casts its vote. And suddenly, days later, Egypt gets the phone call saying no more oil is coming north.
and Egypt really needs this because Egypt is hurting in a lot of ways, economically, socially. Let's just talk about the situation there. What's happening?
Sure. This comes at just a terrible, terrible time for Egypt. Now, Egypt was prepared for this. We can talk about that if you'd like, how they were prepared for that. But in terms of financially and economically, ever since the Arab Spring, Egypt's economy has taken just a tremendous hit. If just looking at it from a tourism standpoint, which is Egypt's probably its biggest industry, its biggest draw of foreign currency, it's if you take a look at the numbers of tourists back in 2012, they averaged something like 15 million tourists per year. Now they're down to, I think the latest showed it somewhere around 10 or slightly over 10. So a third of the tourism industry has dried up. I think back in December, they were averaging, before the Arab Spring, 2.6 million visitors in December is a big month for them. This year, they're expecting around 1 million. So just a dramatic fall off. And of course, with all the tourists not arriving, that's a huge amount of foreign revenue that isn't coming in. If you look at their various tourist towns throughout the nation, some people describe them as basically ghost towns. Some of the most beautiful beaches in that area, you can have almost to yourself. And businesses are closing up. There's a large expat community of Brits that live in Egypt. Of course, British Airways canceled all their direct flights this year to Egypt because of the terrorist threat after the Russian jetliner was shot down earlier. So now there's this foreign income, this industry is just not there. And actually, The Telegraph ran an article earlier this month saying, will the tourism industry ever come back? Because what's happening in Egypt now is all these businesses are shutting down. And when they shut down, they get dilapidated, they run down. And you know, what was once a pristine tourist attraction starts looking like something that maybe, you know, was something from the 1950s or something where nobody's going to come to that because it's dangerous and it's run down and it's dirty and those sorts of things. So That's the image that they're struggling with now. Plus, you know, just the fact that terrorism is a bigger problem in Egypt these days. So against that backdrop, now we take a look at, I mean, Egypt's economy, it has had all kinds of other forces pulling on it. It's not just tourism. It's got one of the highest birth rates in the Middle East. Its population is growing incredibly fast. It is one of the largest food importers in the world. It has a massive debt. And most recently, they had to devalue their currency. And Egypt's financial problems got so big that they went to the IMF for a loan. And the conditions for this loan were that Egypt had to implement many reforms that it had been resisting. And IMF had given them loans in the past, but Egypt had always been able to say, okay, well, we'll do part of this. Well, now, just on the 14th, when they took this last loan of $12 billion, they were forced to devalue their pound. And they devalued it by about 45% overnight. And that just caused food prices across the nation to skyrocket because Egypt imports almost all of its sugar. It imports, it's the biggest, I think it might be the biggest importer of wheat in the world. One of the biggest importers of wheat in the world for pasta, a staple in especially a staple for poor people in Egypt. They also, they're importing rice these days as well. So there's all kinds of foodstuffs. Egyptians have to pay to import, and now their currency is plummeting. So this is causing all kinds of problems for the poor person on the street being able to feed themselves. They're seeing, you know, their food costs, the price of a falafel in I was reading in I think it was an Egyptian paper, just the street food of the common person, lentils and wheat and pasta and oil to cook your food. Overnight, it went up by around 40%. And now it's still going up because they're having shocks and supply shortages and all kinds of things now. So unemployment's up. Youth unemployment is huge. There's just a lot of social pressure on Egypt. Now the Saudis have cut the oil off. And so you throw that on top and you add on to it. The IMF says you can't subsidize fuel for your people anymore. So fuel prices are going up. Condition of the loan. Electricity prices, you can't subsidize, offer subsidies. So people's electricity bills, all of this is hitting at once in Egypt. Food, fuel, and housing costs all at once are being hit. What every person needs to live. So there's a lot of social unrest growing in Egypt right now. And those are the types of conditions that are historically have tended to precede regime changes.
Well, yeah, that's the obvious next question, isn't it? Is what might this social pressure do to Egypt politically and geopolitically?
Yeah, very good question. Now, as I alluded to before, Egypt was prepared for Saudi Arabia to cut them off on the oil. And news had been leaking previous that Egypt had been putting out feelers to Iran and Iraq, which are basically the only other two sources of free oil. Of course, Iran now has free access to the international market with oil. And basically, a couple of Middle Eastern newspapers reported that Russia brokered a deal between Iran and Egypt, that Iran would supply the oil to Iraq, which Iran, I'm sure, would be very happy to do since Iran and Saudi Arabia are nemesis in the Middle East. However, word leaked on that, and both Egypt and Iran denied that that was taking place. But what we have seen since then is that Egypt had worked out a deal with Iraq. And Iraq is providing Egypt the oil that it needs, that Saudi picking up where Saudi Arabia left off. And of course, Iraq basically is in many ways a puppet state of Iran. So Iran may be accomplished, you know, through Iraq what it would have accomplished anyway had it directly supplied the fuel to Egypt. But it is basically throwing a lifeline out there to Egypt, say, hey, look, if Saudi doesn't want to back you, hey, we're more than willing to work with you. Let's throw an olive branch out here and let's see where this can go. And this is the type of sentiment that several Middle Eastern newspapers are starting to pick up on and just openly question, hey, what's going on? Egypt and Saudi Arabia used to be these close allies. And now we have Saudi Arabia cutting Egypt off with oil and Egypt getting its oil from Iraq and Iran. What's going on here? This could be something pretty big in terms of Middle Eastern geopolitics.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how Saudi Arabia responds to that, because it seems like this really could be a pretty significant tipping of the balance in Iran's favor in terms of regional supremacy.
Well, I think Saudi Arabia will have to be very careful about this, because Egypt is a bit of a counterbalance to Iranian power. Certainly is. If Egypt were to get on board with Iran, boy, Iran's power would just grow exponentially in the Middle East. Now, from Saudi Arabia's perspective, they might be seeing Egypt as, look, if they're not going to support us on our positions, you know, we're spending, oil prices are down, we only have limited finances, we don't have as much money as we used to in the past, and here we have Egypt not supporting us on Syria, in United Nations, and they've been unwilling to help us fight the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen either. You know, what are we getting from this relationship? So, yes, I'm sure Saudi Arabia is very worried, but they may also be looking at it and say, well, you know, these are the cards we have, mm-hmm. and that's all we can do is play with what we have.
So interesting, because when we look at the relationship between Iran and Egypt, this is something that we've talked about a lot. Over the years, biblical prophecy indicates that Iran and Egypt will be closely aligned, that Iran will be the senior partner in that relationship. And so, in a sense, you see all of these factors at play. It's hard to say, well, A will lead to B will lead to C, but you could certainly see how this could unfold in a way that would lead to an alignment that we haven't seen to this point.
Absolutely. And that was, you know, one of the purposes of the article was just to highlight these trends and see how there are these changes that are taking place in Egypt. And that really does could fit a narrative that would quickly fulfill many of those prophecies that are talked about in places like Psalm 83 and Daniel 11 and elsewhere, that does show, as you mentioned, that there is going to be this change in alignment between Saudi Arabia and Egypt going forward, and that at some point in the future, we will see a much closer relationship between Egypt and Iran and a more distant one between Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Robert Morley about the relationships between Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Iran. He's written an article on this subject. It's called Egypt Oil, A Seismic Shift in the Middle East. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
This past Saturday, Cuban dictator Fidel Castro died. It's been remarkable listening to the kind of positive eulogies that we're getting from certain leaders in the West, including Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Britain's Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, Ireland's President Michael Higgins, European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. The Obama administration released a statement that managed to avoid saying anything negative or positive about this man. We wanted to discuss the real legacy of Fidel Castro, how we should remember this man. To talk about this, I have trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Great to be here.
So why don't you start by just talking about how Fidel Castro came to power?
Right. Well, he was actually the second longest when he died head of state on the planet, Queen Elizabeth being the only one who'd actually been around before he was, because he'd come into power in the 1950s, was famously like this socialist left-wing insurgent against President Baptiste in Cuba, President Baptiste being an authoritarian ruler, kind of in the mold of like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, where he was definitely an authoritarian president, some would even say dictator, but pro-America, or at least willing to negotiate with the American regime. Castro really made his mark in the insurgency against him to overthrow him, and famously made all these promises that, like, well, as soon as I'm in power, we're going to have free and fair elections, there's going to be freedom of speech, there's going to be freedom of assembly, and there were still quite a few people raising eyebrows then over whether his past actions actually had any indication that there'd be anything like that. And indeed, there wasn't. I mean, as soon as Baptiste was out of the way, he declared a socialist state in the early part of 1959. For the first few months was really kind of taking protesting almost too much, you'd think, on like, I'm not a communist, I'm just a democratic socialist, until he eventually canceled those free and fair elections that he had been promising, and in the end part of 1959 gave his what's now a very famous speech on December 2nd, where he said, I'm a Marxist-Leninist, and I will be one till the day I die.
And he followed through on that. He made good on that promise.
He made good on that promise. There has never been, since this time, any... And forget free and fair election. There has never been any election for at least the top position in Cuba. There has not been freedom of speech. There has not been freedom of assembly. He established a police state that's five times worse than anything Baptiste ever had dreamed up. I've got some statistics I prepared for this interview from the Cuba Archive Project, just highlighting some of these egregious atrocities against the Cuban people, where they're saying that 78,000 people have died trying to flee the island and get away. They said that they know of that there's almost 6,000 political dissidents who've been killed by firing squads, well over 1,000 political assassinations, over 5,000 people who've died in various rebellions to try to overthrow the Castro regime. and it's probably anybody's guess how many political prisoners. In the earlier years, Castro was very famous for anyone who'd even speak against him, throwing them in prison for 20 years. Now the prison sentences, he's still arresting people the regime he established is still arresting people at an alarming rate. The length of the prison sentence has been cut down a little bit as he's kind of squelched most of the resistance against him.
So many of the, those with more socialist and left-leaning tendencies in the West, they are really praising, a lot of people have praised just this excellent healthcare system and the excellent education that Cuba supposedly has. And yet, if you're talking about tens of thousands of people who not just tried to flee, but died trying to flee this wonderful system that he established down there, that should tell you something about the quality of the system down there.
Well, I guess for the first point, again, the excellent healthcare system is probably one of the more disgusting things even someone as vile as Fidel Castro had ever done, is almost like combining his healthcare with political, with his crackdown on political dissidents to turn a profit. He was funding a communist insurgency in Africa, I think it was Angola, where he had all these political dissidents. And so to raise money, he was trying to send blood over there for the soldiers that were getting died. So since he had all these political dissidents and a state-run healthcare system to boot, that was their mode of execution, is just hook them up to an IV and suck them dry while living. And so it's literally just suck the life out of you until you've, I think they drained about 7 quarts of blood per person. And so they're, I don't know, maybe they killed them after that, if they had a little bit of life left in them, but I think you die fairly shortly having 7 quarts of blood taken out of you, and then exported that to Africa to do blood transfusions for communist insurgents who are trying to take down the government there.
Okay, well, let's talk about Russia, because another huge part of why Fidel Castro posed such a danger to the United States was the fact that he had such a close relationship with the Russians. Obviously, this is in the middle of the Cold War, really at the height of the Cold War, and probably the most dramatic incident in the Cold War.
Right. Definitely after Castro made his famous speech declaring himself a Marxist-Leninist, he became part of the Communist International and had very close relations with the Soviet Union. That is kind of probably the biggest thing Castro has been famous for, is his role in the Cuban Missile Crisis, where American surveillance satellites had determined that there was a buildup of nuclear missiles on Cuba, Soviet nuclear missiles. And Kennedy, realizing that there being nuclear missiles 90 miles from the southern tip of Florida, this is a threat to America's existence, having to issue the ultimatum that the Soviets were going to have to withdraw these missiles, or he was going to have to send soldiers into Cuba to dismantle them himself. And then there's this huge tense standoff as they're trying to figure out, are the Soviets are going to back down, or are we going to proceed to nuclear war? Most analysts say it's probably the closest the world's actually ever come to nuclear war. Mm-hmm. And I actually have a letter or a copy of a letter somewhere in my office from Fidel Castro to Nikita Khrushchev saying that actually encouraging the Russians to bomb the United States with nuclear warheads if American soldiers went into Cuba. He's saying that if any American soldiers land here, regardless of the cost to the world, it's like you need to deploy those Russian nuclear missiles against America.
This is the man that these leaders are praising. This is the same guy. This is
exact
Fidel
same guy.
Castro writing a letter to the leader of the Soviet Union saying, if American soldiers come into Cuba, drop nuclear weapons on the United States.
Right. Yeah, this is definitely saying this. If there's an American invasion, he said, we need to do whatever's necessary to keep Cuba from being reconquered. And if nuclear war is it, then that's it.
And Khrushchev was actually the one who said, well, just hold your horses a little bit. This is
right.
More serious than that. Go ahead.
Khrushchev was definitely the more the more reasonable of the two, where he's saying that he said, if I'm trying to call a bluff here, they said, if America backs down, we'll keep them. will keep the buildup in Cuba. But if it's if America sends troops to dismantle those missiles, they said we need to call a stalemate and just take them back ourselves. I'm not willing to start World War III over you guys.
Yeah, and I don't recall the Prime Minister of Canada giving any great praise to Nikita Khrushchev when he died. And yet we're here praising Fidel Castro.
No, yeah, that's true. And of course, it was a different Prime Minister of Canada then. Sometimes you have to wonder if it was a member of the Trudeau family of Canada, what they would have said. I know they've praised Castro fairly highly. They've praised communist China fairly highly as well. So it's I don't know what his stance on Khrushchev is, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was not.
It's
my stance.
It's really worth going back to thetrumpet.com and looking at that article by Gerald Flurry, our editor-in-chief, The Deadly Dangerous U.S.-Cuba Deal, where he was talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis and just what a strategic threat it posed to the United States. And again, like, this is not a previous ruler over Cuba. You know, you look at, say, the nuclear deal that was struck with Iran and the kinds of problems that were that happened at the time of the Iranian Revolution happened under Khomeini as a different leader, at least. But here we're talking about the exact same guy
that was
in power during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And even now that he's dead, it's still his brother who's in charge, who was his right-hand man during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it's definitely the two Castros there.
Yeah, and this regime is they have strong relationships with a whole lot of states in the world that the United States is considers sworn enemies.
Right. Obviously, the Soviet Union has collapsed, and they do have decent relations with Vladimir Putin. But definitely since then, they've developed both the Castro brothers have developed much closer relations with North Korea, Iran, Syria. A lot of other nations that we are currently concerned about their nuclear programs. Mm-hmm. I had a list that was actually back just in 2011. The Cuban officials allowed the Iran-backed terrorist group Hezbollah to set up an operational base in Cuba. Mm-hmm. More recently, in 2013, just barely a couple years before President Obama tried to raise the embargo, Panama authorities seized a Cuban ship carrying, I guess, quote unquote, undeclared weapons of war from Cuba to Kim Jong-un's regime in North Korea. And even in 2014, they found Cuban operatives in Syria giving Bashar al-Assad probably some of the same advice and tactical support that they were giving to the communist insurgents in Angola once upon a time.
It's just, it's amazing that this is the regime that we're hearing praise from people in the West. And it seems to be this kind of, I mean, I don't know if there was any statement that was more positive than the one from Justin Trudeau, but there have been several others who have said, well, you know, there were some controversial elements of his rule, but still he was an extraordinary leader, you know. And they focus on some of the positive aspects of his regime, but it's just one more instance of this romance that the left seems to have with authoritarian leaders.
Right, and it's definitely some of those like Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders. They've said some nice things about Castro, but they also said some nice things about Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, mm-hmm. or even some of the left-wing dictatorships in Central America. And it really is, in part, it's based on the fact that Castro did give, he made education free and he made healthcare free, which are these huge goals of the radical left. Now, mm-hmm. granted, his free education was a state-run propaganda mill that tried to squash political dissent by brainwashing children and giving them no option to go to a private school or homeschooling or any other organization that wasn't going to indoctrinate them with communism. Mm-hmm. And even his state-run healthcare, I mean, it is free. There are nurses who have testified that it's been weeks since they've been able to find a Band-Aid in stock. So it's not great. There's a reason 78,000 people have died trying to get across the Straits of Florida to get out of there, because it's... Yeah, education's free and healthcare is free, but it's horrible healthcare, and the education is just teaching their children to report their parents as political dissidents in favor of the Castro regime. But the other big thing is, and it's almost, we still do see this today with like some of the left-wing support in America for like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, is that the president before Castro, Baptiste, was an authoritarian pro-American president who's viewed as like a puppet of America's colonial empire. And so there is definitely amongst the radical left to romanticize Castro as like this anti-American, anti-colonial freedom fighter. Mm-hmm. And so even if his regime did turn out to be horrible, threatening nuclear war and sucking the blood out of people alive and killing tens of thousands of political dissidents, they're like, well, it's like, that's bad, but he still was anti-American, and he still was for healthcare, and he still was for education. And those are three things that the radical left just really loves, and so we'll give him a pass.
Remarkable stuff. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the real legacy of Fidel Castro. He's working on an article about this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Andrew, we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
During the second week of November, students at some American universities were so emotionally distraught they couldn't take a test. Professors said, well, we'll postpone the examinations. What life trauma struck them and perhaps their professors all at the same time? Well, it was the electoral victory of Donald Trump. Elsewhere, you had weeping supporters of Hillary Clinton, crying on the sidewalks, marching through the streets, screaming profanities, posting hateful threats online, spray paint on the sides of buildings. This was an amazing example of young liberals catastrophizing. This is having sky is falling emotional meltdowns over normal, non-apocalyptic events. There was an article about this phenomenon in The Atlantic about a year ago. It's called The Coddling of the American Mind. And the authors noted an example in Yale University where the administrators, they told the students, don't wear certain costumes on Halloween. And there was a professor that gently suggested through an email that students should make up their own minds. They should take responsibility for their own decisions. And then if there were any offenses, just talk about it, have a mature conversation about it. Well, some Yale students were so offended by the idea that there would be actually people who could wear costumes that were deemed culturally offensive. They started skipping class. They started skipping courses. They said they were losing sleep. They were suffering emotional breakdowns. And they vulgarly and publicly attacked the email's author and her husband and demanded that they be fired. Whatever young liberals are learning or not learning right now in American institutions of higher education, they are definitely learning how to be offended. They're definitely learning how to let their emotions slip from the leash. Now, giving offense can certainly be a form of evil, but so can taking offense. Victim thinking, hypersensitivity, this is happening more and more, and it's not just on elitist college campuses. It's a spirit that fills our age, and we're all susceptible to it. If you don't recognize it and kick it out, it's going to fill your mind. The fact is, if you fail to master your emotions, you're not really running your own life. You're susceptible to emotional manipulation from all directions, from people you hate, from people you like, from forces far beyond your control. Proverbs 25 and verse 28 sums it up really well. It says, "He that has no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls." There is so much evidence in what is happening in the world today to show how true that really is. Unrestrained emotion is a force so potent that it can engulf and endanger entire countries. It's endangering America today. It's endangering other nations today. Now, what's going on here with emotion? When we take offense, we naturally react with negative emotion. And emotion is not weakness. It's not a flaw in human beings. It's not an evolutionary quirk. It's something that God created. It's part of what makes us human beings. Emotion can be one of the most enjoyable blessings that we possess. Without it, our lives would be bland, flat, colorless, hardly worth living. Our relationships would be boring. Our jobs would be monotonous. God gave us the power of feeling so we can experience joy and love. We can have real deep relationships. We can even experience anger and jealousy, fear, sadness. Through emotion, we experience a lot of variety, a lot of depth of thought. And it comes from God because he is emotional. He experiences love. He experiences joy and hatred and anger, indignation, jealousy, concern, grief, sorrow, compassion. There are a lot of scriptures that show God demonstrating these emotions. Now, he doesn't have the physiological changes that we experience with emotion, but he has deep, powerful, profound states of mind, and he created human beings in his likeness for the purpose of growing to become like him. And really, when you put it all together, it's clear that God gave us these physiological changes in our bodies in order to help us understand the depth of his thinking. So when we learn to manage our emotions, we're learning to think like God. Emotion is a great gift. It's not the opposite of and a counter to reason. Emotion and reason actually work together beautifully. They are motivational tools that really complement and enhance each other when you master your emotions. How skilled are you at handling this critical part of your life? Are you constantly buffeted toward the extremes of the emotional spectrum? Or on the other hand, are you casual or indifferent about things that you really should feel deeply about? You probably don't scream demands that people be fired when they uphold freedom of speech. You're not rioting over election results you don't like. But it's important to think about how you take offense and maybe the subtler ways that you react negatively. Why do you get offended? Well, there are a lot of reasons why we take offense. You can think of many specific reasons. Maybe you feel someone is criticizing something you did, or you feel they should have given you more credit. Someone isn't giving you the respect you deserve, or you're sensitive about some problem in your life you haven't dealt with. You're upset by someone else's superficial quirks or imperfections, or you're upset when they fail to measure up to your expectations, or you assume someone else's actions are caused by the very worst motives. The common thread in all of these situations where we take offense is vanity. It is self-love and self-righteousness. It's the wrong kind of pride. And where does that come from? Well, the Bible actually reveals the author of that thinking, and that is Satan the devil. Satan is the god of this world who deceives the whole world. You can see that in Revelation 12 and verse 9, 2 Corinthians 4, 4. And he was the author of sin. The essence of that sinful attitude that first started in him was self-love. It says in Ezekiel that his heart was lifted up because of his own beauty. Now, God had created that beauty, but he became lifted up because of it, and that attitude is the opposite of the outflowing love of God. Under the devil's influence, the world today exalts self-love. It promotes taking offense as a kind of pursuit of justice, like it's going to make the world better and fairer and more peaceful, but it will not. It will never work. In fact, that wrongful self-love can be found at the source of all offense, interpersonal friction, conflict, hatred, emotional pain and suffering. If you nurture it, if you encourage it, that's always going to lead to more problems. In fact, in the Bible, the Greek word for offended is skandalon, and that can refer to the triggering of a trap. If you take offense, it's a trap for you. You succumb to negativity and resentment and debilitating emotion. Those who go about establishing their own righteousness, self-righteousness, rather than submitting to God's righteousness, the Bible says that that they're going to suffer for that. The self-righteous person is very attuned to what he perceives as everyone else's flaws. Anytime there's a conflict, he feels like it's the other person's fault. He takes quick offense. He feels like the victim. That's exactly the way Satan thinks. I'm going to talk next week about how to overcome offense. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Callum Wood, Robert Morley, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Dwight Eisenhower. History does not entrust the care of freedom to the weak or the timid. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.